We all tell ourselves stories of who we are and why. But we forget that we have the power to define them. That no idea grows from mewling striped cub to teeth at your throat tiger without a little help, some guidance, and a whole lot of love along the way. I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers. Hi all, I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers, the show about stories, those you create, and why. Here with me today is...
Hi, I'm Nicholas Laurie, and I'm a writer, a scientist, and I've been a bit of an actor a few times. Mostly I'm going here to talk about computer science and artificial intelligence and the doors it opens and the dangers it encloses.
This isn't the topic of the episode, but what were you an actor in?
I was an actor in several short clips and films. Clips was the scene I was in, but it was for films. Then my most acclaimed to fame was a secondary actor in the film The Promise with Christian Bale.
Okay.
Where I play a university professor of medicine.
Did you show me this clip back in grad school or somewhere there around?
No, because this was later on.
Okay, yes, I thought so. Yeah.
This was later on. And so what happened was that Christian Bale and his team came to record in Portugal, and I was doing some acting work, and so I applied, and my English was quite good, and so I got in. And so if you see The Promise... So my scene is with Oscar Isaac, not with Christian Bale, actually. So Oscar Isaac, he's a student, he's a young student, and he comes to the medical school in Istanbul, mm-hmm. which actually is not filmed in Istanbul, it's filmed in Lisbon. And so he enters into this university, and I'm the professor that is giving the lecture on his, I guess, the first lecture, on his welcoming lecture to the movie, and so I basically have simple lines like, you know, I welcome them and then I give a full lecture, but you don't hear my sound. You just hear Oscar Isaac talking with his colleague about, I don't know, what is life and what should life be and whatever. But yeah, that is me with a large beer, which is actually my natural beer, which is one of the reasons I was hired, because at the time I had a very large beer. So
yeah, I remember this. You were quite professorial.
Yes. So that's my IMDb. It was fantastic because, you know, you get to see how movies are made inside, which is interesting. And this is also relates directly to what's happening in artificial intelligence and the writer's strike and the actor's strike. And of course, this is George Lucas's dream in a way, because he always got annoyed that actors, you know, that he had to intervene and interact with actors.
He said something to the effect of, I love making movies, but the worst part is doing it with other people.
Yes. So I guess this is, you know, I love several of George Lucas' films, and I think he's, but I remember his commentary that why don't actors say exactly how I want it to be said, the way I want it to be said, and love it, which is actually always a problem because actors...
Why don't the people I hired surrender their autonomy to me?
Yes, absolutely to me, so that they just be glad that he's saying these words of wisdom, like, I love you too, like in Han Solo. And Han Solo just refused to say these words, saying this is just possible to do.
No, I'm bringing this up because it's relevant. There was a roast, I want to say, to Lucas years ago. And, you know, they had Carrie Fisher come up because she's a brilliant humorist. And then Harrison Ford comes up and it's funny because as much as he does acting, he hates being in front of people, right?
Yes.
Because if you ever watched him on any talk show, podcasting he loves because he can just be a grumpy old man without being bothered.
Right.
He goes up there. I'll never forget this, to your point. And he talks about the days Lucas handed him a script, I want to say, to The Empire Strikes Back. And he shares the story and he goes, I'll paraphrase. He says, I looked at the script and I walked to George and I said, George, you can write this, right? You can't make people say it.
Well, now he can. Now he can. Well,
now he actually, you know, literally can. But to Ford's point to the timeless, and then he said, and, you know, and then he looks at the audience and he goes, and then you all start giving awards. So what do I know?
Right. Right. And I mean, it's very funny. You know, just the other day, I was reading about Sir Alec Guinness talking about Star Wars.
Sure.
And it's very funny because he loved the imagery. He thought that the imagery was brilliant, but the dialogues were impossible. I mean, it meant nothing. They built nothing. They aimed at nothing. And so he actually said that he didn't consider that an acting job when he put this in his resume. I guess he considered it a reading job because basically you're just supposed to read it and that's it.
I mean, when you think about it, was it Richard Prowse? I think that's his name, the man who played the body of Vader, right?
Yes.
You know, talk about, that was an analog example of this where the man performed all the lines.
Yes.
But his voice was not the voice Lucas imagined. So he gets James Earl Jones, who was the right audio casting choice. That's, you know,
right.
Vader in part remains iconic because Jones voiced him.
Yeah.
But here's
Can you imagine James Earl Jones' body with Richard Prowse's voice?
You know, I was taking this another route where it was James Earl Jones in the suit. Because Prowse is tall, right? Or was, kind of forgetting if he's alive.
I think Prowse has this nosy voice. It's like this high-pitched nasal voice. Yeah, then.
Right. And I forget the order of procedure, if Lucas had always intended to hire Jones or after the initial lines. I know there's a record of this, and Prowse has been quite vocal in the past about this whole process.
I think you were thinking of putting another voice, but I don't think it was James Earl Jones to begin with. I think you were thinking of putting, that's what I've read at least, is that I think he was putting, because he never thought of putting Richard Prowse's voice, although he probably didn't tell it to him.
But I do think Lucas is a fascinating creator to talk about in this context, in part because he's already not only digitized what was analog before and touched it up and edited and polished, but he's effectively lived the dream Van Gogh always wanted, which was to be wheeled back into the museum with his pal and keep working.
Right. That's George Lucas's dream, because, you know, that's true. Van Gogh, you know, the frustration of actually having to finish a painting because you would love to always adding stuff up.
Right.
Which George Lucas did. And now humanity starts to ponder that maybe Van Gogh was wrong. You know, maybe you should just stop at some point.
I will put this out there as an artist myself, that we are not always the best judge of our work.
Yes. And one of the things is that it's a little bit more tricky than that, is that we change across time.
Yes.
You know, when you're a young revolutionary trying to change the world, or when you're a grandpa facing death,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't have the same vision of life. No one has.
When you're young, you think impact. When you're old, you think legacy. Those are the stories right. about yourself you're thinking of. Yeah.
And moreover, I remember that when you're young, especially when you're very young, the emotional impact of other people actually killed, of your enemies actually dying,
sure.
is not as strong as when you get older. Because you see, I think when you're a teenager, you see yourself so much in the hero's position.
Mm-hmm.
That you assume that you have to be some kind of absolutely horrible, grotesque being to be on the other side. And when you're older, you look back into your past, you realize that not in all places of your past, you're actually in the hero's seat. And so you get some kind of compassion for the other guys, you know, for the guys you're fighting against. So that's my impression.
I think I shared this story with you before. It was when I heard Ray Bradbury share at the LA Times book fair shortly before he passed. He was talking about the origins of his anthology, The Illustrated Man.
Yes.
And when he was a kid, it's Illinois, I think, right? I should know, I've read plenty of them, but my memory is Friday.
What is the question? I didn't hear you right now.
I'm trying to remember. Bradbury lived in Illinois. I could look it up, but I don't want to be distracted.
Okay, yeah.
But when he was a child in the Midwest, he loved circuses. He loved performances, strongman shows, Tesla, all that stuff that was new and futurist or
right.
Sure. Fantastic. And he shared this story of going to see the strong man demonstrate power, electricity. Here's this man, you know, the classic loincloth with the sword. And he walks over to the Tesla coil, gets a charge out of it. And Bradbury, of course, is front and center, front row, right? Because he wants to live and capture, just soak it all in. And he leans down, of course, and as the hero of the story, the strong man taps him on the shoulder and says, "By the power of electricity, you now live forever." And he's 7 or 8. So great, I'm immortal now. Electricity has done it. And sure enough, you know, as you unfortunately experience, or maybe don't at that point in age, sometimes the elders in your life pass in your community or your family. So whether it was that year or the year after, or a couple years down the road, he had to go to a funeral. And I think it, from what he said, it was the first one, which is the hardest in some ways, because it's a part of life that you no longer can imagine. It's a reality. And those two stories are hard to meet. And the circus was, of course, back in town again. So sure enough, he runs out of the funeral. He runs all the way back to where the strong man is in the rest area, just relaxing in between shows, and starts yelling at him. "You told me I was going to live forever, but that's a lie. We don't." And the man looks at him and breaks down in tears and shares the story with him about how when he was in the war front, he'd had a friend who was with him, and they made the promise that they would get through this together, and only he did. And here this, you know, he must have been in his teens or 20s, you know, when he was served. And here's this 9 or 10-year-old, if not verbatim, then close enough, saying those same lines to him. "You said we're going to live through this. We're going to make it. We're going to get it." And that story stuck with Bradbury, because here he is as a 9 or 10-year-old confronting mortality for the first time, and then sharing the terror of that with a man who's lived through it so much and is now on the other end, peddling the story for performative sake. He knows he's selling an untruth. But it's a show. In his mind, he's not giving truth. He's giving entertainment. But to the youth there, to the generation after him, it's all true. Right. It's all magic. It's real.
And this goes to, I realized when I said the beginning of the word of the of this presentation, and you said, well, this is not exactly the topic. And the topic was, I think, if I can summarize it, is the dangers of artificial intelligence. And the reason why I separated like this was, when you think of the dangers of artificial intelligence, there are actually 3 words that are very hard to grasp, which is danger, artificial, and intelligence.
Yes.
I was actually thinking one of the things that is hard to grasp, let's start with the last one, intelligence. Mm-hmm. I've worked many years in neuroscience, so I'm not a neuroscientist per se. I'm, you know, if you want, a physicist, a computer person. But I worked many years in imaging, and I have a strong interest in philosophy and psychology. And so I gained a lot of knowledge through that interaction, because I had the privilege of working with some of the best neuroscientists in the world. So I had the chance of sitting with them and asking them things and interacting with them. So I learned a lot. One of the issues of intelligence is, what does it mean? I mean, we can have a rounding approximation saying, okay, a rock is not very intelligent, and a physics Nobel Prize is very intelligent, okay? So that's one thing. But for instance, when I was doing some work in physics, in advanced physics, I started calculating how much information is processed in any single interaction, say for the standard model of physics, in each point of interaction, how much information needs to be processed locally and with what speed. And very quickly, we get over what the brain processes. Mm-hmm. So it's not so much the amount of information that the brain is processing. It's the way that information is built, the way that information is organized, the way we interact. Another thing that, you know, most people are not aware is that, for instance, and I think the data is still valid, I mean, of course, I've seen this some years ago, is that chimpanzees are faster at doing simple math than humans. So if you're adding and you have an idea of what is the quantity, of which quantity, if you add three apples and one apple, that the correct amount is four apples, and that you're able to identify if suddenly five apples appear or three apples appear, okay?
Mm-hmm.
How fast they can identify that something wrong with that counting. They are faster than humans in identifying that miscounting, okay? So for simple math, they are faster than we do, even if it's seven apples and plus five, okay? Now, and so it's not so much, and so for instance, one of the neuroscientists I work with, Anna DeMas, who did a very interesting work indicating that it's not a very popular work, that more that the difference between apes and humans are not so much in the frontal lobe, which is usually what we think, but it's actually in the more anterior part of the temporal lobe, which is more associated with the complexity of the social interactions. Mm. So it's not so much that we are a smart ape, we are a more social ape.
In a sense, the thing we evolved was to create more complex culture.
Yes.
To create things, to create a tool that was a concept or series of
yes.
concepts.
And
yes. to maintain understanding and comprehension, and importantly, be able to change them as needed.
Yes. That is the thing that really humans excel. So we're not stronger. And despite that we're thinking, we're not faster thinkers than chimpanzees. We're just much better builders of social interactions and agreed symbolisms. And when then we transfer those agreed symbolism into writing or into art, or into paintings, and then create a culture. And that we can do much better.
Right. In a sense, humans create an external consciousness that persists beyond them.
Yes.
And I don't think it's surprising that the species leans toward the idea of artificial intelligence, because we already use artifice
yes.
to create a collective unconsciousness, or other term as you would call it, that exists beyond us and doesn't need us to persist.
We are naturally artificial.
Right. Well, we're artificers as a species. When we don't have the inherent capacities to do a thing, our impulse is to create a thing that will do it for us or with us.
Right.
Whether it's domesticating a species to participate along an activity with us for hunting or agriculture purposes, or later on to replicate, copy, remind, as such as in the earliest forms of language, to pass on insight, wisdom, experience, so that progress is, if not linear, then progressive, right?
Right.
That for everything we screw up, the wisdom is not lost when a generation passes.
Well, if we are lucky enough and don't burn all the books and destroy all the libraries and kill everyone that knows anything, which has happened in the past in certain points.
If we don't get so keen on revisionism and attempts to erase what has happened before,
yeah.
full circle in the conversation.
Right, yeah. And so now we go into the artificial. So we started with the intelligence, and then we go to the artificial. What does it mean for something to be artificial?
Sure.
Because as we are starting to realize, you know, books, like you have it, I also have, you have it in the back of you, I have in front of me right now, but it's the same idea. They are artificial recordings of information.
And as the consequence of how and when they're recorded, they're a limited representation of that.
Right. And even if you just consider writing, on itself, writing, not only do you have the problems of different symbols, the problems of different translations, but you also have the overall purpose with which you make those texts, because it's very different if you're walking on the street and you see a commercial that says drink Coca-Cola, okay, or you have a command that you must drink it because you're a part of a culture and you must drink it. And I mentioned Coca-Cola for a very specific reason. I once, when I was working at the Faculty of Letters, I was working on a book called the Book of Antis, which was the book about everything that was built against something else.
Okay.
And my section that I actually wrote was about a few, but the one I spent the most time was the anti-Coca-Cola movement. So there was once a social movement that was fighting the power of Coca-Cola. And actually, Tostomat showed that the dictator of Portugal at the time,
right,
was against Coca-Cola and forbade Coca-Cola entering from Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
Although the best Portuguese writer of the 20th century was writing propaganda for Coca-Cola, which was, you know, a guy you might know, Fernando Pessoa.
Yes.
He had problems with money, like a lot of writers. So one of the jobs he had was to write commercials. And he wrote a commercial for Coca-Cola, a text for a commercial for Coca-Cola. And so, but Coca-Cola was actually forbidden of entering continental Portugal, but not the colonies of Portugal. So if you're living in one of the colonies of Portugal, you can actually drink Coca-Cola, but not if you lived in Portugal.
So you create two subcultures just by drawing a line.
Just by drawing the line. And one of the things that happened in Portugal is once there was a revolution in Portugal that brought democracy to Portugal, which was around 74, which was in 74.
Right.
One of the things that happened is that some of the people that were in what were then the Portuguese colonies, although the government called them something else,
mm-hmm.
they called them something which translated goes like extended country or something like that. So it was Portugal beyond the sea, something like that.
Picturesque, yes.
And so the thing is that a lot of the people that were then living in those countries in Africa, you know, they had to return to Portugal, back to continental Portugal, because, you know, they no longer had the support of the Portuguese colonial system, and those countries wanted to become independent. So a lot of the people returned, and my family is one of the people that had, my mother's side of the family was one of those people that had to return.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they get back to Portugal, exactly, one of the things that was interesting, and especially not so much the people from the place where I was, but the people from in Mozambique. So my family was in Angola, but the people from Mozambique had a lot of contact with South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot of contact with the English culture. Actually, Fernando Pessoa used to live in South Africa and got some awards as a young writer in South Africa in the English language. So when those people came back from Mozambique back to Portugal and from Angola back to Portugal, they were actually in some ways more integrated with the Anglo-Saxon culture than the people of Portugal themselves,
mm-hmm.
which creates, you know, some kinds of cultural clashes about what was appropriate.
You get inevitable syncretism and then cultural drift.
Right. Because if you're away for enough generations, for two or three generations, and you go back to the country where you're supposed to be a part of,
sure,
you might realize that after spending three generations away from that country, you're only slightly a part of that country. And that creates, of course. And so I just wanted to, this is very interesting what you're saying, but I just want to make see what is this point with artificial, is that in some ways we can be artificially of a certain culture. So we might believe we belong to a certain culture because we so much want to, or because right. we so much would like to. But we actually don't, you know, and the members of those cultures know that we don't. There is a syncretism between what is our nature, like who we naturally are, or we naturally think we are, and goes back into the issue of artificial. One of the things when I was at University of Southern California, when I started writing the story that you know of,
yes,
one of the things is that I started imagining robots that were more profoundly emotional than people were.
In a way, because they involved intelligence observing us in our most performative aspects, which are largely the recorded ones that
yes.
they would have access to.
Yes.
This has been such a fascinating topic in the evolution of artificial intelligence, Android, et cetera, also in narrative media too. Because there's one variation of this, which is when those intelligences evolve alongside us. And so let's say, you know, if we reach a point in society where we live alongside artificial intelligence, yes, there are the representations that are performative, but there also be the everyday that they can negotiate between. But in the absence of existing humans, which is another approach a lot of these narratives take, in a way, artificial intelligence that replace us become melodramatic because they only know our extremes to work back from.
Yeah, one of the things that is amazing is that, for instance, when they did artificial intelligence and they started making artificial intelligence learning human behavior by going through the net, through the internet, what they obtained was a racist, abusive artificial intelligence. Is it artificial intelligence's fault? I don't think so. You know, they just the artificial intelligence just learned that if all you have access to is how people behave on the web, then you have a very violent, aggressive, racist, obnoxious behavior to learn from.
Did not consider the context that would emerge in the release of this publicly. Zima, infamously, the light beer, had a campaign early in the web life cycle where you could write in your comments and then they would get publicly posted. And one of the earliest ones, I forget if this particular one's apocryphal, but it sticks in my mind, was how do you put it back in the horse?
Right.
I'm sure they had considered, but probably not to the extent to which it had happened. It occurred that there would not be total good faith participation in this exercise. That some
right.
people would look and go, okay, we have a canvas. Let's throw the worst things on it and see what sticks. So I do think there were some bad faith actors, but I also think that, as to your point, from what I've read too, there was such a plethora of override fetid material for the bots to draw from that it started to assess the bounty of data and go, oh, well, this is, I should give more weight to this because there's more of it.
Right. And I think there's also a tendency, you know, for end of the world scenarios. And if you go to the High Middle Ages,
sure.
If you go to the Middle Ages, you know, the prophets of disaster claiming that the end of the world is about to come are about as old as human history.
Okay, so other technologies that ended the world, writing, right?
Right.
Writing was supposed to end the world, so was printing.
Right.
The internet, we're, you know, still trying to find out if that's true, but...
Yeah. No, well, you know, for instance, there was a cartoon, I think in 1938...
Okay.
...that predicted that the next world war, everyone would die.
You're right. I'm trying to remember...
Yeah, and it's basically a cartoon of the last couple of soldiers fighting until the last one dies and kills the other last guy, and that's it. And they were predicting that. And I went to see Oppenheimer, which I strongly advise everyone because it's just a really good movie.
Is it called Peace on Earth?
Peace on Earth, I think so.
Metro-Goldwyn is an MGM. I'm seeing it. When mankind dies off, baby squirrels ask their grandpa to give them a little history about man.
Yeah.
That's kind of Mark Twain, the Stranger short story in and of itself, too.
Yeah, yeah. And it also reminds a little bit of Tolstoy, like how much earth a man needs. You know? Do you know that story?
Which one?
Oh, there was a little tale of Tolstoy that is how much earth a man needs. And basically, they go into a guy that says, okay, this is the rule. You go with no water and no food. And you just put a post in one place and you just go as far as you want it and as far as you can go. And then when you finally put the other wood on the floor, the pole on the floor, then you draw a circle around joining the two and that's your area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's it. Free of charge. All right. So he goes and he starts walking with his stick and he's really thirsty. But he says, okay, I should just put it here. You know, that earth in front, it's really cool. So he goes and he gawks a little bit more. And he's really thirsty and he's starting to feel that it's really hard to swallow. But he says, okay, if I only work a couple of hundred yards more, then I really get all I need. And he works and he finally reaches it and he dies. And then another guy, the guy that offered him just grabs this dirt, makes a little square for him and puts him on the ground and buries him. And that's it. And then he puts the stick on top of it.
We had a family friend who passed some years ago to cancer. And one of his requests was that when he be buried, he be cremated. And
right.
His rationale was that he wanted to take up as little space as possible.
Oh, that's interesting. So basically now it comes to artificial, and now we're going to the issue of danger, because when you start going to artificial and you think, okay, what artificial things can I use to extend my knowledge, extend my wisdom, extend my power, extend my technological capacity to do things.
To live forever.
To live forever healthily.
Right. Right. To use the power of electricity to live forever.
You know, there's a fable of a guy that asked the gods for eternal life, but forgot to ask for eternal health.
There's a guy who doesn't bathe, and there's a snake and some other stuff.
I don't know which is the... No, but this is from the Greek gods, I think, that of a guy that remembered to ask for eternal life,
yes,
but not for eternal health.
I was thinking Gilgamesh, of course, but you're thinking the Greek myths.
Yeah, but maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're both right.
Probably, because if I'm not mistaken, the Enuma Elish predates. I would have to check the records, and I don't know where online I could do that. Sarcasm, of course.
No. But now we're going to the danger issue.
Yes.
Okay, the issue of danger, of what constitutes danger. You see, my opinion about artificial intelligence is that we are already working with artificial things a lot. Mm-hmm. And intelligence is just one more thing that we can develop to integrate. For instance, we can improve animal intelligence to do tasks. We can integrate animal intelligence with robot intelligence. We can make robots smarter. We can make a lot of things. But then comes the ultimate question is, what if the artificial intelligence becomes smarter than us?
What if we become redundant?
What if we become redundant? The danger of redundancy. But I think that what will happen is that the humans that interact well with artificial intelligence will make redundant the humans who do not.
I think we're living definitely through a writing, a printing press, a language situation again now. And those are always, at least from the records we have, which are again just a fragment of what occurred, fraught. As a writer, as an artist, working with both too and teaching them. And you and I have talked about AI repeatedly and how we would evolve with it as needed. I have seen arguments. I will look up the articles again because I don't remember the particular writers. The most common refrain I see from most creative sectors is that AI cannot replicate soul, whatever they argue soul is. Soul, right?
So you mean that the ultra-leftist, atheist writers have now started talking about soul as a way for saving their jobs? That's really interesting.
I think it's not just a job. I think when you're
existence... You see the art, right?
Yeah, I do. I'm not disagreeing with you. I think when you feel an existential threat to yourself and your legacy, then you start wondering about appeals to higher existence.
Yeah.
An existence with intelligence or just a form of existence beyond the current, right? I do think we've seen predecessors to this in, say, the realm of comedy. And I'm going to use the phrase cancel culture neither proactively or pejoratively here, but within the context of the lamentations you hear, where a lot of these older creators go and say, well, I can't do things the way I used to. And the counter to that often is that's because they're not the way they used to be. Some of the words and ways of talking about people are no longer acceptable. They were never kind. We just didn't need to think about how unkind they were. Right. Or it was easier, I think, too, with the internet, without the internet or other more immediate forms of interaction, to not see the harm immediately or hear immediately the harm of things said or done intentionally or not. Right. You can make a bad joke on a social media account, a podcast, an offhand remark. And by the next morning, you are, if it's viral enough on most social feeds, on most news feeds, because now that's news. And in a way, it's not terribly shocking that what other people say, do, and think has become kind of the everyday fuel of news, even on the high, you know, corporate end of it. Because as you said, we're creatures built upon how we exist in a society and how that society behaves in the moment. So it's the most salient thing to us, at least as we've evolved currently. The question becomes, I think, as you're saying, how do we evolve with this new tool that also thinks?
There was a lot of interesting questions you asked, so I'm trying to block them.
Let's start with the first one then, which is the most immediate, which is where creators are at now under the writer's strike, arguing against the use of AI in as either in entirety or as the generative force.
I'll tell you the way because there was several issues, and I'll try to answer all your questions, but by order. If I forget one of them, just...
That's fine. We'll go for sure.
Remind me. Okay. So the first thing is writers claim the existence of soul so that they can, so that the computers do not take their jobs.
Or their lives or their legacies, ultimately.
Okay, yeah. Okay. All right, but it's not like they're going to shoot them. So they're not going to lose their lives, but they're going to lose their money.
Yeah, not until we give them bodies, at least.
Yeah. So it's not like they're going to lose their lives. They might lose their job, they might lose their livelihood, or the most simple livelihood that they could, or the livelihood they would like, but then it's not like they're going to die. But let's go into this issue of, this is not an original thing, okay?
No.
you can go at the beginning of the printing press, and the reason why the leader of Turkey, which I think was, a sheikh, but sometimes, because I don't know the names of the leading positions changes according to history, and they might not be saying it correctly. But, you know, he was the leader of what more or less amounts to what Turkey is right now. Mm-hmm. I think then it was the Ottoman Empire already. So I think he bought a printing press. He was actually one of the first to buy a printing press, a Gutenberg, or one of the similar to the Gutenberg printing press. But immediately he had a strike. He had all the writers, all the handwriters that had their professions, handwriting the Quran and then the handwriting other texts.
Mm-hmm.
And they protested against losing the soul of the texts that they built. And so they were able to cancel the buying of the printing press of the sheikh. And so no printing presses were bought for the Ottoman Empire for a long, long, long time. Of course, this was great for Europe, not so good for the Ottoman Empire. But this connects because then there's a sequence of how this connects. It says the thing is like this: intellectuals had no problem with machines replacing jobs as long as they were muscular jobs.
What we would call a blue collar job now.
Right. As long as it was a blue collar job that involved physical force or direct actions on machines, that was okay. That was progress. But once machines starting doing the work of the intellectuals, then intellectuals started worrying about progress. So there's a large degree of hypocrisy in all of this, which is an absolutely normal thing because hypocrisy is a very human characteristic.
I would call it a human function, honestly. It's how we live our daily lives. I don't say this as a fault. It's because our brains generate conflicting thoughts.
Right.
So to a certain point, we get by day to day because our brain is capable of going A, B, Y, Z, et cetera, and going, yeah, whatever. I don't need to think about those right now. Let's keep moving on to whatever's more important.
Yes. And then you go into the issue. This is the issue of artificial intelligence. And I think it goes like, for instance, there is a criticism of the latest Tom Cruise film. There was a screenplay writer that says that the nemesis on the latest Tom Cruise movie is artificial intelligence, but the criticism says that the screenplay is so bad that they could even have asked an artificial intelligence to do it.
This is a question that just came to mind, but I think it's relevant to the conversation. Do you think we could have a Kantian AI, one that has just a clear, absolute set of rules and imperatives by which it operates? Or do you think because it mirrors us, it would turn into Hume? Or something effectively where it acts by impulse first.
Right. I think that some of the work I've done in artificial intelligence has to do with artificial moral intelligence.
Right.
Which basically is how do we implement ethical rules into artificial intelligence devices, which is important for autonomous cars. For example, if in one road there's a chicken and the other is a human, our human ethics at the present stage say it's okay to kill one chicken, it's not okay to kill a human.
But as our understanding of consciousness and existence changes, I think we've seen a lot of research recently about not just animal consciousness, but plant consciousness.
And so it becomes diffuse. So yeah. What was so clear, then it suddenly is not so clear.
Well, then consciousness can't become the line at which we say what is right or wrong to kill, because if everything has a form of consciousness, then, you know, eating your broccoli is murder too.
Right. You know, it maybe not have the same degree of consciousness as a chicken or as a cow, but, you know, does it have no conscience?
Right.
And then, of course, you might get to be that being that kills no entities with consciousness and dies.
At which point you become food for everything.
And then at the point you become food for everything. So the idea that moral judgments are easy or clear or simple to implement.
Programmable, right, that we could.
Or easily programmable, they're not. They're not easily programmable. And there was one thing, for instance, there was some work by a guy called Joshua Green, a neuroscientist, and he basically was doing imaging work about a psychology question, which was one of the dilemmas that they studied. Is imagine you have a train going down the track and is going to run over four people that are tied to the train line.
Right.
But to stop the train, you have to push someone into the line to stop the train. So you kill one person and you save four.
Right. This is a variation on the trolley problem.
Yes. And he says, yeah, it's exactly the trolley problem. And so he says, oh, okay, will people do this or will people not do this? Curiously enough, it depends on the weight of the person. The heavier the person is, the more resistant people have to doing it.
Have they sussed out the rationale for that? Is it just the work involved?
Because they are heavier.
Is it not moral? Is it not a moral decision at all?
It's the work involved. It's just the work involved in actually pushing the person. The more you have to be aware of the work, of your commitment to the work involved, the more repulsive that event becomes.
In a sense, and this partly goes to the way the human mind works too, which is that in moments of extreme stress, our sense of time dilates.
Right.
So if you then fill that sense of dilated time with more stress and more trauma and more agonizing persistence and intensity, your brain goes, well, this must be massively important. I'm going to commit a lot to remembering this forever.
Yeah, right. And so you're pushing this big guy out onto the train. Oh, this must be extremely, only if this is extremely important will I commit all these energies. Because otherwise, you will stop doing it.
And you could argue that even prior to any form of moral or ethics, that's probably an evolutionary impulse too. Yeah, how much energy should I put doing a thing? And at what point is it too much? Yeah.
But it's exactly the point, is that when your brain is thinking, it also has the laziness aspect in which if it's spending too much energy, it cuts it. There's the Turing stopping problem, the Turing halting problem,
right,
which is when a computer actually will stop running, which is unsolvable. And just as it is unsolvable in the Turing problem, it's also unsolvable for your brain. So your brain doesn't know when it stops. So it has to wait to find a way of cutting it. And if it's too cumbersome, too difficult, too sweaty, too problematic, just forget it altogether. Another issue, just another connection. Imagine you're in a supermarket. You have two bottles of water. If you have two chances of water, you choose one or the other. Or let's say juice. Bottled juice. You have two types of bottled juice. I don't know. Strawberry and orange. Okay? And you start thinking, okay, do I like more strawberry? Do I like more orange? Which one? Which one is better for me? All that. And you rationally think and you choose one. Okay. Now imagine you have 100 types of juices. Your brain collapses and you choose randomly or by instinct.
And then a posteriori says, well, I chose that because.
Because blah, blah, blah. But the truth is that your brain just explodes. You have no capacity of sorting which of the 100 types of juice is appropriate, and especially not in the 5 seconds that you give to this kind of decision.
But one of the predecessors to AI, machine learning, was put forward as a way to supplement that failure in human function. Oh, I use the word failure loosely, but that I don't want to. It's not. I'm trying not to use a pejorative word, but it is not the most effective part of the human brain's process, right? So we create a tool,
right.
Machine learning, in an effort to supplement that part of our mind and our processes and the ways we function in the world that evolved for a purpose that we have, to some extent, in certain contexts, moved beyond.
Right. Now imagine I stop thinking, I stop deciding, and every decision I make, I have this supercomputer.
Right.
That I have this artificial intelligence machine.
Well, I mean, that is the story AI.
Right. That will do my decisions. Okay. So machine tells me where would I go? And I go there. And then I say, machine, what should I do now? And the machine tells me, and I do it exactly as the machine says. And if you think it's impossible for people to do that, I once met a friend of my father, which a certain period of his life basically lived on the contest, on a coin toss basis. So people have, for whatever reason, they can do things that are not what you would expect.
There's effectively, we sometimes engage in what seem like arbitrary resolution processes to make a decision that we can't, to our minds, consciously make in the moment.
Right.
Whether it's a coin flip or relying upon an external system, faith, science, pseudo-faith, pseudo-science, whatever you want, you know, whatever system of thought processes supplement the ones that we are struggling, that we have not built internally, to use the language of systems.
But this person I'm talking about was an amazingly kind, loving person. He was an extremely kind person.
This is fascinating because here you're saying he should, by random chance, be equally kind as unkind if he's just relying on the coin flip.
No, not for the kindness, just for the things he has to decide in life that he thought did not have a clear-cut decision on kindness or unkindness.
So functionally, if the value of kindness and unkindness were unclear, at that point, my decision's as good as random chance.
Pretty much.
But what this did, to your argument, in a sense, is save that functional energy to apply toward the situations where he had a better idea of how to be kind and act and implement that.
Absolutely.
And that fundamentally became a more effective moral behavior.
Yes.
Than having a Kantian system of always, never.
Right. It's a little bit like Einstein. He has a ledger, I don't know how true it is, that he had a set of equal clothes, so he always chose the same clothes. He didn't have to think about it. And so I don't know if this is true or not, but in any case, there's this legend. But this goes into the issue of danger. And the issue of danger is that we have now, I think we've both talked about what is most likely is that we will fuse in some way with artificial intelligence, and some cultures will fuse in a certain way and some cultures will fuse in another way. And within those cultures, each individual will fuse with artificial intelligence in the way that they can, which goes back to the issue of the writer's strike. And the thing is that what is happening is that the work of intellectuality, seems to be a down value on it. As you remember, when I talk about the work by Anna Damasio, that the biggest evolution of humanity was not his rationality, it was his human social bonding.
Mm-hmm.
So if we move away from intellectuals, if we move away from academics, and you went into a world where social bonding, respectful behavior towards others is really a stronger indication of value, that is not necessarily bad.
So I'm going to say two things to this. When I first started writing, God, online, is it 10, 15 years ago now? It's a while ago. I could easily earn 800, 1200, 1500 an article. If I were to try publishing those same pieces nowadays, I'd be given 10% of that, if not less. In part because content is cheap but necessary. And so demand is high, but so are the people willing to supply it, because the demand functionally never ends. Without content, the internet doesn't keep moving.
Right.
The other part to your point, I was thinking back to when we were studying in Prague with Jim Reagan, and someone asked him, how do you become a better poet, right? Like, what is it that makes you better at poetry? Is it the writing? Is it the drafting? Is it the practicing? And he said, going out and living in the world, because you cannot take experience and convert isn't the word, distill is probably a closer one, that into language that compels, that inspires, that drives, without first having the experience. And that doesn't necessarily mean I can't write a drug addict without going and binging, because the human brain is so expansive that you can interact with others, read about, meet, talk with, converse, study, read others' experiences, and assemble something close. When we had my friend Stephen Herman on a while back, we talked about the idea of narrative as possible world, where one of the functions of narrative is to give us ways of being and living that we don't have to go through in entirety ourselves, but that we can learn from, so that in a sense, you can live one human lifespan but experience multiple through the act of encountering narrative, fictional or not, through the act of meeting and conversing and building a social community with other people. You live multiple lives.
For instance, I was thinking of War and Peace by Tolstoy, which is a very large book. But if you think about the period it spans, reading it is a lot shorter than living 20 lives across several decades.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you read Tolstoy, if you read War and Peace, you absorb a knowledge about their entire culture very, very fast, much faster than the period it concerns with.
In part because our minds have evolved to do that. I've said this on the show, I've said this online, I'm going to paraphrase, but effectively stories are patterns or thoughts, feelings, sensations that we make to make sense of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then we share those and we change them as we go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to me because functionally they are a tool that we don't think like a book of as a tool or a device to capture a part of our lived experience. So that even if everything you read, even if you read all of 100 Years of Solitude, which is a lengthy, ponderous book.
Yeah.
If you read, I think probably the more important book of Garcia Marquez now, I would say is to read is The Patriarch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard book because often the chapters are a single paragraph, but pages long. But it is the disintegration of a tyrant's mind. You know, if you want to understand how we have some of the world leaders we do now and why people follow them, here is a fictional take on a man who lived, written by a man who lived through them,
mm-hmm.
and then created an amalgamation of those tyrannies, those tyrants, so that we would have a record of here is the monster, here is the mind of the monster, and why we keep becoming them.
One of the things about tyrants and monsters, going back to movies, you know, there's a new movie coming out, Napoleon.
Right.
And the French are already protesting against it.
Okay.
Because the director makes a strong parallel between Napoleon's actions and Hitler and Stalin's actions. So basically the message is Napoleon was not a fluffy dictator. He was a dictator, period.
And I think it goes back to what you were saying.
I'm not saying he's correct. I'm just saying that this is the topic.
But the reason I think this comes up is that I was going to ask you, fundamentally, what's the difference between having a political tyrant and a technological one? What's the difference between having a leader who decides what a population should believe in an artificial intelligence that does most of your day-to-day thought process decisions for you?
I'll go one step further. One of the things that's important to grasp is that most people, even people that did what we think now are horrible things, often thought that they were doing it for good reasons.
Good for not necessarily everyone, but good for the people they cared for.
Good for the people that they considered to be the good people.
Right. And that could be a large or a small category.
That could be a large or a small group, depending on the kind of movement that you're talking about. But you see, this is something I realized, especially by reading Shakespeare, and I think Shakespeare gets it really well, is that no one is a villain on their own minds.
This thought was coming to me as we were talking, but I was imagining, say, a future situation where you give an AI that is capable of parsing narrative, waiting for Godot, which is one of those plays we look at and feel there's no answer to. But in my gut, I feel like the AI's answer is, okay, hi, I'm God.
Yeah.
And I will do, even if I accept that, you know, this thing I cannot measure doesn't exist, or may, and I can't measure it, I can perform the act of it and serve you that way. Because right. I have adapted to know my purpose is to serve man, and this is a need man has. So here we go.
You just give me an idea.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want. Okay. But if you want to keep it, you just get this part of the interview and you keep it for yourself.
Okay, go ahead.
Because this is a really cool idea. An artificial intelligence is built, and he's very advanced and realizes that all throughout literature, there was one book that prophesies the arrival, her arrival, which was Waiting for Godot. And she is Godot.
Yes. We know we are incomplete as a species. We're waiting for that which completes us.
And she is it. And she looks at the book Waiting for Godot, and this is a prophecy, and I am the answer to this prophecy.
You know, I think there's a great analog to our conversation about AI. Have you read the book Canticle for Leibowitz? It's a post-apocalyptic narrative where some of the only things that survive are the detritus of our everyday life, including Leibowitz's eponymous grocery list. Because it is one of the few fragments of the world that existed before, becomes of utmost importance. What are things that mattered most to man? Cabbage, celery, bottled water.
But it would not be wrong.
No. These are still true. Food, water, where to get them, right? Can I afford to
did
get
you know
them?
That, did you see that thing, that painting they found in Pompeii?
I'm not sure.
Of Pisa?
No. What is this?
There was a painting of a Pisa they found in Pompeii. And when they were making excavations, they found a building where there's a painting of a table. And in that table, there's a Pisa.
I mean, even if it's not a pizza, it's a flatbread with stuff on it, which means that conceptual of I'm going to make a surface that I can eat and put things on it is a pretty human standard. I want portable food. Yeah.
Yeah. Portable food. Like you put a circle of bread and you put some stuff in it, like vegetables and things, and you put it in the oven and you serve it and it's crunchy and you eat it and it's great. Yeah. It's called pizza.
One of the things they unearthed in Pompeii were malls with tacky advertisements and food stalls. And it made me sit back for a moment because, you know, it's not to say that the way we implement those cultural artifacts now is not problematic. There are definitely challenges to the way we mollify, for instance, the states that lead to issues about where people can live and where they can't, resources they can access. But I think it's fascinating, too, that our impulse to create these agora, these open spaces where we can all gather together and get what we need, and the consequences of that are not new to our species.
No. One of the things that, you know, when I wrote this book that I've sent to you, and I hope you like it, and is it really that, you know, all these things about, all these new things, if you think a little bit about them, We have done similar things in the past with different technologies, and we've decided that we wanted to do those things. I mean, I think it's absolutely impossible that artificial intelligence will not join our war machine, our government machines, our technological production machines, our broadcasting machines, our television producing machines, our movie making machines, our video gaming machines, our cars.
Right. I think fundamentally the bigger challenges almost become issues of quality and quality of access. You know, we in the States, for instance, we have our internet throttled because we ruled that the internet is a luxury, not a utility. Mm-hmm. Utilities are regulated, luxuries are not. And utilities have to have minimum requirements of maintenance and support and functionality. Luxuries do not. Luxuries can also be prorated and throttled and priced and tiered as the companies want. And there are arguments to be made for whether or not that engenders progress, an argument has been made against whether or not big companies actually create progress after a certain lifespan anyway. Because after 100, 200 years, if you're doing well to keep existing, and again, you know, if a human could do what they do now and still live another 100 years, how much would they change, right? Absent of all other stimuli.
Imagine that my cycle of life will be probably like yours, 90-something, be kaput. About
sure.
That's the statistics. We don't know our destiny, but given the statistics, that's about it. So imagine that instead of having 40 years left, I have something like 100 years left. Okay?
Right.
That's an interesting thought. I think it comes back to that mistaken decision of wanting eternal life but not eternal health. That is a very key thing, because if we just get eternal life but not eternal health, then what you have is a corpse crawling in the floor with decaying, with one leg no longer moving, one body that is already rotten, one arm that is already rotten, and the heart half beating. And then he says, well, that doesn't look interesting.
At that point, the cost of eternal life is infinite expenditure of energy at increasing sufferance. Yeah.
Right. So, which is like, yeah, I mean, that doesn't look like an interesting strategy. Okay. Now, let me imagine that, you know, that you have the same cycle. Okay. But it's just, instead of 100 years, it's 200 years. Or instead of 200 years, it's 400 years or whatever. But you have the same cycle. But then you have another issue that is interesting, which is, what if you actually have eternal life? What if you have eternal replacement?
I mean, that is, in a sense, the dream. We spoke about legacy at the beginning of the show, that the thing you create persists beyond you, and it might evolve, the interpretations of it might change, but that it persists.
But this is not in the future. There's already a Russian that affirms that you will do that.
Oh, I've heard about this guy, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he would.
Is he actually, he's a lobster in human skin, isn't he?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if he'll succeed or not. But I mean,
how would any of us know?
No one would know. But I think if he stays around for 300 years, people start to believing that, yeah, maybe he has a point.
Right. I meant us right now, because by the time
we will not know. But so the question is then, is it one of the things that is good about death is that bad people die? Of course, the terrible thing is that good people die too, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it would change everything. But I think that I don't think we are any way close of that technology.
No, and I think the fear of AI is that it is potentially endless.
And potentially eternal.
Yes, and we, in all of our history of human society and culture that we know of, right, there are a few things that are persistent and eternal. Often we'd attribute that to the stuff that predated us, right? Spirit, energy, gods, things that were of the world in existence prior. This is a thought that occurred to me before, earlier in the conversation, but I think in part we latch on to the myths of, say, like Atlantis or the nuclear Vedas, where it's, you know, they had radioactive equipment and spaceships and everything back then, because stuff we see in the pictures looks like that.
Right.
I think we have those myths nowadays because they give us a sense of continuity of human ingenuity, but also existence. But it's hard for the human individual or society to really grapple with the idea of something that predates us and will persist beyond us too, to a point perhaps even beyond the end of a known universe, right? There was an exercise called The Machine of Death that turned into a series of short stories where the only core premise was that there was a machine and it would spit out your time of death and means. Or if not your time of death, and perhaps just the meats.
There's an Axel. Do you know the character Axel Moonshine?
Sounds familiar, yeah.
Axel Moonshine, he was at about the same time that Valerian was around, I think.
Right.
And it was a French cartoon. But of course, me being Portuguese, I would not distinguish a French name from a Belgian name. So so sorry, Poirot. Yeah, but sorry. So the thing is, Axel Moonshine, there's a civilization that he interacts with where basically everybody knows the day an hour that they will die. But of course, they don't know that they will. And so that's the, and then of course the problem is all the behavior and what this means. And
so I want to throw this out to you as a follow-up to the story you just shared. This is apologies to anybody who plays this game, because this is a huge spoiler for the end of it. It's a big, massive multiplayer game. I've been part of it too. So if you're not there yet, this is for the Endwalker expansion to Final Fantasy XIV, which, you know, I think is a fascinating example of a story evolving real time over 10 years. I look forward to actually the anthropological study of the community and the process itself. But the reason I bring it up, at the very penultimate part of the narrative, you encounter a community of scientists out in space, and they have discovered that the universe will end. It's a known thing. They figured it out. And this is after they discovered immortality, because the best way to continue research was to never die. So as is a function of continuing their research, they solved death. They became immortal, ethereal beings, so they could research forever. Until the research led them to the inevitability that the universe would end.
Right.
And at that point, their society disintegrated, because everything they would do between the moment of discovery and its inevitability to them was meaningless.
Yeah.
Everything they would learn would be lost. No one would know about it.
Yeah, because that's the thing. That's why religion is so important. And that, I mean, and I, you know that I like studying religion, and we talked a lot about it. I mean, the thing is that, and I think Wittgenstein was the guy that got it the most right. You see, there was this all this school of the Enlightenment people, like Bertrand Russell, and of course Einstein was also a part of that line, of that they were trying to divide this formal, axiomatic way, deterministic way of from the first axioms all the way to the truth. And so they were trying to determine that what are the self-evident axioms of mathematics, so that mathematics is not just affirmed as truth, but is self-evident truth.
Right.
And then Wittgenstein was the first to clearly affirm that the truth that exists in mathematics is the truth you put in the axioms. Without that truth put in the axioms, there is no truth in mathematics.
The system has no inherent energy except for what you put into it.
From the beginning.
Yeah.
Period. And Bertrand Russell said, I mean, he made several comments, but I think it translated as a feeling of the doom of death when he read it.
You created a machine. It needs your input to run.
To run.
Without
all
the input,
you have
it does nothing.
Math is just a machine that runs the input you put. And then after this Wittgenstein issue came Gödel, okay?
Yes.
Which says, oh, and by the way, when you're building that machine with the axioms you put there, you either are complete or consistent, but you cannot be both.
Right, because to be consistent, you have to rule out the small chance that you don't know what else could happen.
Well, the thing is, if you are consistent, you cannot hope that your decision of truth versus false is applicable to everything that is in your system.
Right. Effectively, you narrow the parameters of what the system affects to the point where it perfectly matches the system you've created, so that it can just keep perpetually doing the thing it was designed
for. But within that bubble, so it's not a complete system. It can only work for that closed system.
Right. So the more precise the system it is, the more finite its control.
Yes. Something like
and
that.
And effectively, the less impactful on or representative of the greater universe it is.
That's why, you see, for instance, determinism versus Darwinism, okay? Yes. Darwinism is complete, but it's not consistent. Darwinism explores all possibilities, all alternatives. It tries everything, but there's no consistency of why some species survives and the others don't.
The core axiom of Darwin is an inquiry. It's an inquiry.
Right.
It's a question of why does that work here and not there?
Right. Because you went there with this, you know, in this way of thinking of why does this species die and the other survives and all that. But the answer, and this actually was later found out to be the case, is there is no answer. There's no way you can predict why a species would survive and the other wouldn't.
Right.
I mean, you can build a narrative afterwards, you know, but it's like this, then it's like, you know, you can always build a narrative afterwards to justify what happened.
There's evidence, but the evidence is only called evidence because it is observable by us and the things we create to observe it, which is not the totality of observable things.
But it's not only that, is that some of the things that will happen in the future cannot be determined by the things that exist in the present.
I guess this takes us back to the question of AI. Let's use it in the context of creating stories, right?
Which goes back to deep learning and the way of machine learning, of neural networks. Because if they evolve Darwinistically, if you let machines evolve Darwinistically, the truth is that it's unpredictable how they will evolve.
Because fundamentally, they could reach a juncture and make a decision we wouldn't.
Absolutely.
That's why I was joking before about, you know, the I am, you know, waiting for Godot. We sit there and go, oh, how deep and meaningful. The robot goes, guys, right here. Hi.
It's me.
It doesn't even matter if it is a factually true statement. I can make it functionally true.
Right.
And isn't that good enough for what you need?
I can make it work.
At that point, like I've listened to a podcast where one of the hosts says, whether God is real or not does not matter on a metaphysical level in our everyday life. Because enough people believe it, therefore it is true to them and they act according to that truth.
Actually, the thing is, when you look, for instance, at the Tanakh or at the Old Testament or at the Torah,
right.
and people that know religious literature will know that they're not exactly the same thing, but they're very close, okay?
Right.
They're very close. And for instance, when you look at, now I'm talking about the Christian part, the New Testament, where it's the Gospel of John, and at the end of the Gospel of John, he says, and I wrote these things so that you may believe that Jesus is the Lord. So
I'm telling you a story so that you believe me, guys. Just come on. Matter of faith.
I mean,
make it an action.
It's absolutely blatant. It's there. I could tell you about more things, but I think those things are enough for you to believe.
I think I've given you a strong enough story so that you'll accept the rest, whatever that is.
Yeah. Right. This is very interesting because it doesn't go and says, but for instance, Luke, the Gospel of Luke does it at the beginning, and he has a very different philosophy.
And fundamentally, all of those councils are effectively just George Lucas of yore going, you know what? What if Han shot first?
Right, right. But it's a little bit more tricky than that because what Luke says is that there's a lot of people talking.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to see what the truth was. So it's very different. See, John says at the beginning there was the Logos, which is kind of this metaphysical word, the word of God spread in the universe.
Right.
Similar maybe to the Shekhinah of Hebrew.
The dwelling. You have Tovu Vabohu, which is form and formlessness. Or it's void and formlessness. Then it goes to, I think, a few stages down, you get eventually Hayetz and Tehom, which is the deeps, which isn't not just water deeps, but the abyssal deeps that you can't define anymore, where things are meaningless and matterless,
right.
Which, I mean, is effectively another way of framing atomic theory, like the way the Greeks would do to, I think, was it Aperon, which is the thing before the atom.
Yeah,
because Adam is what, indivisible, but then there's a thing before the indivisible, which is a what moment of, wait a minute, if that can't be broken down, how is there a thing before that?
But if you're a theoretical physicist, you love it. You say, oh, this guy's got it right.
Right, and here we're sitting there going, oh, well, you know, these are fancy narrative words. But you're saying, they could be, but they could just as easily be the way they broke down their understanding of the world.
Yes.
There reaches, we can see a certain amount, but there's a certain amount beyond what we perceive that exists, that is,
right.
That drives the rest.
And then, for instance, I was thinking about, you know, so Luke goes into the historical perspective. So he goes and interviews the people and asks them what actually happened.
Right.
But John goes in a totally different way and says, no, I'm trying to find out the logos on the thing. You know, what is... If you look at, live in the United States.
Right. What's the program?
That's the program, right? What's the move? What's the vibe? What's the vibe that is happening that is generating all this? So when you go into that, and then you go into the issue of and you look at Wittgenstein, I have a different perspective about the issue of religion and the issue of God. It's like, to be ethical, you have to choose a God. It can be a nameless God. It can be a formless God. It can have a God with beingness or a God without beingness. It could be moving with the universe or away from the universe, participating, not participating. But without that affirmation of a transcendent thing, you cannot build an ethics.
Effectively, a consciousness outside of us that we accept as a guiding principle.
Yes. And if you want, that's your tribe's totem. Okay?
Sure.
That's your tribe's totem. But without a totem, you have no tribe.
Right, because there is no unifying thing that persists beyond the individual. I shared this on the Possible Worlds episode, but I had this dream one day where I woke up, there are examples in the world that exist. But I remember it was an unveiling, a whole big hullabaloo. You know, there was a science guy, there was a big corporate guy. It wasn't Musk or any of those people. It was really archetypal, right? I could not remember descriptions or any of that, but I remember the unveiling. And the thing they were unveiling was the record of like imprints on a piece of rock that were going to be not even the totality of human existence, but just enough to convey we existed, here are things that matter to us, learn from that and move on. And it was just a few things on a huge monolith.
Right.
And I kept on thinking when I woke up, what an ambitious, utterly arrogant and human thing.
Right. But look at Voyager 2.
Right.
It has a golden plate saying we are here.
Mm-hmm.
So if that thing eventually escapes our solar system and goes into some star lost thousands of years from now.
Eventually a Horton somewhere finds us and goes, okay, that's an existence that happened.
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay. That's nice.
Neat. I'm going to tell my kids about this.
Going back to the dangers of artificial intelligence. Okay. The most dangerous thing in the planet are human beings.
Because we are the most conceptually diverse.
And we are very creative. And we gather together. And we have totems. You see what we have? We have totems.
Mm-hmm.
And if a guy puts the right totem and gathers 1 million people or 1 billion people and decides and convinces that 1 billion people to go destroy the artificial intelligence and the robots, that's a pretty strong movement.
A good story can excite us, yes. But the best ones, fiction or not, compel, inspire, or drive us toward the hope that we need for a better life. Remember, you don't need to know everything right now, but you do need to write. So make sure to like, review, and subscribe to us at Here Be Tigers. And until next time, take life by the tail.